No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show that will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important and affect the lives of all of us. Tonight's show has been pre-recorded because we have a very special guest who was kind enough to adjust his schedule to work us in. So you won't be able to call in, but I hope you'll listen because this is a really important show. Maria, hi, how are you? How's everything in California?
Michael, we continue to be the epicenter in the county that I live, Los Angeles County, of COVID and of our state. And it just gets scarier and scarier. But worse was what happened on Wednesday. I'm really looking forward to hearing what Mark Fisher has to say about that.
Right. Tonight we have with us Mark Fisher, who's a senior editor at the Washington Post. His journalist credentials are way too long to list. We need the entire show to do it. So let me just say he's done about everything in journalism, and he's just written a book with a co-author, Michael Cranich, and it's called Trump Revealed. It's on the New York Times bestseller list. It's the Philadelphia Inquirer Best Book of the Year, and it's the LA Times Most Important Book of the Year. I mean, amazing, amazing, amazing. And before we get him on the show, let me just say one thing on behalf of Maria and I. Our condolences go out to the family of Brian Sicknick. Brian was a 42-year-old Capitol Hill police officer that was beaten with a fire extinguisher and unfortunately died from his wounds. Our heart goes out to his family and friends. Mark Fisher, thank you so much for being on our show tonight.
It's great to be with you.
Mark, was your book not published and then you re-updated it?
It was published originally in 2016 in the middle of the presidential campaign, and then we updated it the following year.
Okay, so you're really up to speed and are going to help all of us understand what's going on there. Thank you again for that.
Well, Mark, let's start with the 800-pound gorilla in the room. You know, who is Donald Trump? This is much what your book, I'm sorry that I haven't read it, but it seems that this is much what you talk about, who he is, what his personality is, how he's been shaped. So who is he? We had somebody on our show a few weeks ago that said he's very aware of the hate speech he uses. He's not a buffoon. It's not that he doesn't understand what he's doing. He's a great manipulator. Is that who he is?
Well, he is a great master of media. That's to be sure. You want to call that manipulator? Sure, that's reasonable. He is an amoral character who plays a role in public, and that role is as a salesman, a showman. He considers himself a showman. He's very proud of that title, and he is. But it's not to, don't take from that the idea that behind the scenes he's a different person. He's just a calmer less provocative version of the person we see in public. When you go talk to him, when you sit down and meet with him, he is the opposite of what you see in the rallies and in his provocative speeches. He is gracious and solicitous. He spends enormous amounts of time. He listens. He doesn't always absorb what you're saying, but he listens. He's remarkably naive and remarkably ignorant, and this is really the result of a lifetime of not reading. I asked him at one point about his reading habits, and he admitted he'd never read a book all the way through. He likes to dip into things, he says. And his whole career was spent as someone who was the salesman for his organization. And he never really had to deal with the details in management. He had people who did that for him. So he is profoundly ignorant. Again and again, I would ask him questions of basic things about his own family history, and he would come up empty. And it wasn't for lack of interest, it seemed, because he would want to hear the details about how his grandfather came to this country, or the fact that his grandfather once worked as a barber in the very same building that Trump himself bought on Wall Street. So he was kind of intrigued to hear that, but it was new information to him because he was so incurious and so ignorant, and because he doesn't read, perhaps he had reading issues, we don't know, but he is someone who curiously lives entirely in the present tense. It's very hard for him to talk about what's happened before. It's almost impossible for him to look forward to the future. And we've seen that in his presidency, just as we saw it throughout his business career. He is stuck in the moment.
Is he a racist?
You know, I talked to him about that at some length. And I told him one of the visits I had with him, I had just come from the airport to his office in New York, and I'd been in a taxi. This is in the early part of the 2016, and during the campaign, and the taxi driver was a Pakistani immigrant, and a New Yorker, and the taxi driver told me, you know, I would really like Trump, except for the fact that he hates people like me because of my skin color, because of where I come from. So I told that story to Trump, and I said, what would you say to such a person? And he was very interested. He said, really? He said that. Okay. And he said, I would tell him that I'm the least racist person who's ever lived. And I said, well, how would you persuade him of that? And he then began, he rummaged around on his desk, and he found a letter from Don King, the boxing promoter. Yeah. He said, Don King, he's a friend of mine. It was just the most, you know, cliched, ignorant kind of response you could possibly imagine. But he genuinely believed it. And so so to answer your question, he doesn't think of himself as a racist, but he has the casual racist vocabulary of someone who grew up in Queens in the 1950s in a well-to-do white community. And so, you know, he talked about people unlike himself with derisive vocabulary as a kid. And, you know, does that make him a racist? Do his policies through the years make him a racist? Do his consistent pattern of blaming or going after black criminals or calling for the death penalty for the Central Park Five, all those things certainly create a record. But, you know, unless you have an X-ray into his soul, I think if you had such an X-ray, you would find a guy who genuinely believes he's not racist.
Yeah.
Mark, could I ask you, because you're referring to actually interviewing him in person, and according to your press, it says that there were 20 hours of interviews with Donald Trump. How did those go down? Were you and your co-author present, or did you split the duties? And what was that like, and why were you given access?
Well, it was a combination. So there were some interviews that were my co-author, Michael Cranish, and I at Trump Tower with Trump. Because we had to get the book done in a really short period of time, we were able to use the resources of our colleagues at the Post. And so we split up some of the segments of Trump's life and had, you know, one reporter who was specializing in looking into his casino casino gambling days. Another reporter who went to the ancestral homes in Scotland and Germany to learn about his grandparents and all of that. So we did divvy up the work. And so some of those reporters had individual interviews with Trump, mostly on the phone. And that was part of the book's research as well. So, and then Michael and I put it all together. We conducted the many of the main interviews with Trump, and then we used the interviews that our colleagues conducted as well. So that was the mechanics of it. And, you know, getting the interviews with him was, as it always is, with remarkably easy, in that when I first called Hope Hicks, who was then his press spokesman for the campaign, this was probably back in March of 2016, or April, rather, I called her up and I said, look, we're going to be doing, the Post is going to be doing a biography of Trump that'll appear before the election, and we would love to have his cooperation. I'd love to sit down with him. And she cut me off right away, and she said, this is a bait and switch. You guys have been calling us about stories you're doing for the Post, and now we learn that it's going to be a book. He's not going to cooperate with you. He's not going to talk to you. There will be no interviews. And I said, well, just please pass that along to him, and if that's the answer, that's fine. And we were prepared for that eventuality because we thought, you know, he might not want to talk to the Washington Post, and we were just going to report it around him, go talk to all the people who worked with him and for him and all of that, and put the book together that way. Well, that was on a Friday. Monday morning rolled around, and very first thing, I got another call back from Hope Hicks, and this time she was just peaches and cream. She said, I told Mr. Trump about your fabulous idea, and he would love to have you here. And when can you come? And I had a suspicion that that was going to happen, because if there's one thing Donald Trump likes to talk about, it's himself, and he has this love-hate relationship with the press. Of course, most Americans have come to see it as purely a hate relationship, but the love part was always there, at least a craving for respect. There's nothing he craves more than the respect of mainstream establishment news organizations, especially the New York Times, but also the Washington Post. And I sort of suspected that he would be unable to stop himself from going ahead with the interviews. And he was actually, every time we had a one-hour interview scheduled with him, he would extend it by another hour, sometimes two more.
Does he ask for any editorial control or oversight?
No, not at all, although he did threaten us. So he said, maybe it was the first interview, he said, I'll talk to you, but if I don't like the book, I'm going to come after you. And I knew what he meant, because one of the previous biographers, Tim O'Brien, was subjected to a $1 billion libel lawsuit from Trump after the book came out. And earlier in our interview, Trump had said, I'm never going to read this book. So I asked him, maybe a little too cheeky, but I said, well, how are you going to know that it's a bad book if you're not going to read it?
Right. Well, that's a great question.
Good question.
And he said, he was ready for that one. He said, people will tell me.
Yeah.
And so,
my people.
Yeah. So he was fully, and, you know, he loves to threaten and he loves to bluster and all of that. And so every once in a while, if he didn't like a line of questioning, he would say, I know this is going to be a bad book. I don't know why I'm cooperating with this and all of that. And so we took the quotes from him about how this was going to be a bad book and he was going to come after us, and we slapped them on the back cover of the book.
You know, I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, in the Italian neighborhood, and it always kind of strikes me the way he talks and the way he threatens. It reminds me of all the stories that I heard as a child from my parents when the mobsters ran our neighborhood. You know, they never said, we're going to hurt you. They said things like, if you do this, you'll disappoint me, or Mr. So-and-so will, you know, will not take it very well. Donald seems to use the same kind of language. And I've always been suspicious of how you open a casino in Atlantic City, New Jersey, without dealing with these guys. Do you think that's where some of his training comes from?
Well, we not only did he he deal with those guys? We have that. We have a long passage in the book about his connections to the mafia. We have named sources. We have he was involved with very serious mob people in the acquisition of land for his casinos in Atlantic City, in the in his ability to complete Trump Tower at a time when the construction unions in New York were on strike, and we had FBI sources, retired FBI sources, telling us that they believed at the time in the 1970s and 80s that Trump was a made man, and you hear this in Trump's language, as you say, and this has been true not just as president, but really throughout his life and career. He talks like a mobster in some ways. Michael Cohn has talked about this in his book and elsewhere. There is that's how he did business. His father had to deal with very unsavory types in getting his real estate empire built in the outer boroughs of New York, and when Trump himself took that operation into Manhattan, he was up against even more formidable opponents who made life difficult for developers in the real estate business. And so, he had to deal with a lot of unsavory people, and he did so in part by adopting some of their language and methods. And he's kind of proud of the fact that he was able to win them over, triumph over them in some ways, get his project built. There's a famous story about an apartment right near Trump's in Trump Tower that was built for and given to the wife of a mob boss, and she insisted, even though she was getting the apartment for next to nothing, she insisted that she wanted an indoor pool in her apartment. And of course, the skyscraper had not been built with the supports to hold the enormous weight of an indoor swimming pool. And so they had to go back in, dismantle some of the supports in the building, and reinforce it with much stronger steel and other supports. And they installed an indoor pool for this woman. It later became the subject of a big state investigation and so on.
Wow. Let's move on a little bit to, you know, what everybody's talking about, what happened at our Capitol on, Wednesday. I was involved in many, I'm old enough that I was involved in many anti-war marches in Washington, D.C. when I was a teenager, and when I was in college. We surrounded the White House, we surrounded the Capitol, but I've never seen anything like what happened on Wednesday. Do you think they meant for that to happen, or do you think they were unaware when they were up there that they had speaking to the crowd that they were going to incite them to this point? Do you think that was purposeful?
You're saying the Trump people?
The Trump people,
that
yeah.
They deliberately
Donald Trump
that.
Himself.
Well, Mark wrote a piece on Thursday about the four-hour insurrection. And the byline is how a Trump mob halted American democracy. So I am curious to see, Mark, what your perspective is on the senator's question about intentions.
Well, I think it's clear that Trump wanted a major disruption. Look, he's he's nothing if not a provocateur, and he wanted to put a lot of pressure on Congress and on Mike Pence to do his bidding and overturn the results of the election. That was his stated goal. One of the great things about Trump is that he pretty much always tells you what his real motive is, and there's not a lot of hidden agenda when it comes to Donald Trump, and so he was quite clear that he wanted to usurp the law and the Constitution and get this election turned around, and he saw his crowd, his people, as one more piece of pressure that he could put in addition to all the lawsuits that failed and all of the demonstrations in the elections offices around the country and all of that. And so did he intend that the crowd would burst into the Capitol and perhaps try to take hostages, as this is now emerging to be the case? There's no evidence of that directly, but he certainly wanted there to be a wide wild scene. He certainly he used that word several times. He certainly wanted people to feel pressured and frightened. And I don't know that he knew exactly how that would pan out. I don't know that he had any role in seeding the notion of breaching the building. But I don't think that really matters. The fact is he incited a crowd to act wildly on his behalf, and they did as they were requested to do.
But according to your reporting, Mark, you said that the insurrection was hardly spontaneous and that it was carefully and methodically planned for months. So do you think that he was the match that went to the fuse, or surely he knew that Proud Boys, QAnon, et cetera, were doing this on social media? Like, what role do you think he really played?
Look, I think there's always been a symbiotic relationship between Trump's desire to rile up his base and the extremist desire to latch on to Trump as a leader, if not a sort of almost cultic leader. And those two realities take place on parallel tracks. Do they sometimes cross? Yes. But is there direct communication with orders being transmitted one way or the other? I don't think we have any evidence of that. Trump has played this game ever since Charlottesville and before of using the extremists as a way to communicate indirectly that he's on the side of whether it's white supremacists or nationalists or any kind of extremism that you might want to attach a label to. And those extremists are more than happy to present themselves as soldiers of Trump's army. But I've never seen any evidence that Trump was, in direct contact with or directly commanding these kinds of actions. He's just, he's inspiring them, which is, wildly outrageous enough.
Yeah, again, I would argue modus operandi of the mobsters that existed in my neighborhood, who were usually on the surface pretty nice people to deal with unless you crossed them, and then you had to deal with one of their henchmen. Never them, always somebody else. So, but what do you think, how do you think this plays in the long run for him? This is obviously going to, be the way we remember him. We remember Richard Nixon. A handful of us remember him as the guy that opened China, but most of us remember him as the Watergate guy. What do you think this is going to do to him in the long run? Do you think this is going to hurt his 74 million supporters? Is going to erode his base? Or you just think, as he said, he could shoot a guy in the middle of Manhattan and get away with it. Do you think he's going to get away with this?
Well, it's all of the above. So, look, he is his base is nowhere near 74 million people. His base is some percentage of, whatever number you want to attach to it, 15%, 25%, 35% of those who voted for him are his real hardcore base, and they indeed would stand and applaud if he shot someone on Fifth Avenue. So he's always been right about that. But the bulk of his voters are people who, a good number of them are the Obama-Trump voters. A good number of them are people who have been consistently trying to send a message of frustration to both parties going back to the 1960s and 70s. These are the Perot people. These are the Tea Party people. These are the folks who have consistently said, look, you're gutting the middle class, and you're not, and neither party is doing much about it. So for that crowd, this last spurt of outrages from Trump is alienating. It's disappointing. It's humiliating. And I think we're seeing what happens with every populist leader, every dictator in history, which is that there comes a point of where the whole house of cards falls apart, and where there is this realization over time that people have been either lied to or defrauded. And certainly anyone who watches Trump for any length of time eventually comes to that conclusion. Now, will his hardcore base abandon him anytime soon? No, they're going to stick with him for a while. But for most sort of reasonable, middle-of-the-road Americans who voted for him once or twice because they were just sick and tired of being sick and tired and wanted to send an outrageous message and were fully aware of his shortcomings and fully aware that he was really not fit for the office, those are the folks who are going to be looking for something else. And this happens with every populist who's ever come down the pike.
Yeah, and that was always an amazing thing to me, is that people could stand there and say, oh, yeah, he's a misogynist. Oh, yeah, I don't like the way he talks. Oh, yeah, I don't like this or that, but I'm still going to vote for him. That was always an amazing thing to him, to me. So what responsibility do we have to take as liberal Democrats? And when I say we, I mean me and my colleagues. What responsibility do we have to take to reach out to this group that you talk about, this large disenfranchised group, the Ross Perot people, the Tea Party people, the Trump people? What responsibility do we have for that? And what can we do to reach out to them, do you think? You know, when right after Trump was elected, I went to talk to a group of women, and one of them stood up and said, as Democrats, we have nothing to apologize for. And the first thought I had was, of course we have something to apologize for. Somehow we allowed this man to get into the White House. So yeah. What do you think that we have to do?
Exactly. I mean, I'm no political strategist, but I am a little bit of a student of history, and I can tell you that when societies come back from this kind of a trauma, they do so not by seeking vengeance, not by going after people and putting them in prison, not by telling people that they were miserable to have supported such an evil creature. In fact, they achieve a rebalancing by embracing all of those folks and giving them a chance to start over and not making them cry uncle. I think there's a tremendous feeling among many Democrats that they want these Trump voters to cry uncle and say, yes, I made a terrible mistake, and I helped bring our country to its knees, and so on. Any attempt to do that, I think, will backfire. I think Joe Biden has been very clear that he opposes that kind of vengeful approach. And, you know, he is, whether it's an accident of history or the wisdom of the voters, he is precisely the kind of character who we've seen in other countries in the past has come along after a period of populism or dictatorship and has said, look, we're not here for recriminations. We want to make things better and relieve some of the frustrations that led to this problem in the first place. And we're all in this together. And those kinds of, you know, as Biden puts it, looking for the vital center. I think a political movement that looks for that. And, you know, Americans chose this year, both in the Democratic primaries and in the general election, they chose, they made a vote for security, stability, and even boredom. And that's right. What Joe Biden stood for, and I think the more the Democrats realize that and embrace that, and you can have a lot of change and a lot of reform within that, but the one thing I think most Americans crave at this point is to not have to care so much about the news every day.
Mm-hmm. So should we impeach him? I mean, given what you said, which I agree with, should we impeach him for a week?
It's hard. You know, it's an interesting debate to watch. I just it seems so wildly impractical given the amount of time left. It doesn't seem even possible for that to happen, and certainly not for it to happen in any kind of reasoned, considered way. Impeachment is not an emergency mechanism. It is something that is a reaction to, high crimes and misdemeanors, but it's something, it's a legal court process that involves hearings and a trial and all of that, and that that's not going to happen in 11 days or 10 days.
But I have to say that given the sentiment of our country, that at least the Democrats set for the record that we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore, however impractical it may be or implausible. You know, looking back historically, we'll see that happened. And which leads me to my question, Mark. You've been with the Washington Post for over 30 years, and I want to hear about what it was like to receive the Pulitzer Prize. But before we do that, how difficult is it for you to separate your opinion from politics in your reporting?
I've never found that hard to do, because to me, the essence of what a reporter does is to try to see the world, to try to see every individual story as through the perspective, through the eyes of people as unlike myself as I can imagine. So that's the job. That's what we do when we're doing it right. And I want every story to be read by the person I'm writing about and have that person say, yes, that's me. That's who I am. That's where I'm coming from. And I can't do that if I'm thinking about my own views. So every story really is an opportunity to push back against whatever my own beliefs might be. And I am not that interested in my own beliefs, so I don't feel any need to present them to anyone else. I did spend a decade as a columnist, as the Metro columnist for the Post, and so in that job, it was my job to present my own perspective. And at the end of about a decade, I thought, well, I've pretty much said what I have to say. I'd like to go back to reporting, which is much more interesting because I get to spend time with and learn about and understand people unlike myself, views unlike my own. That's a whole lot more interesting than sitting inside your own head. And so I happily went back to reporting and editing. But, you know, having been on both sides of the news side and the opinion side, I would have to say the more sort of honest, challenging work is news gathering, because it's all about understanding people who you really didn't get at first.
Because that was one of the arguments about Amy Coney Barrett, was that she's a human being, and at the end of the day, how can she really separate herself from her feelings, from her religion, from her faith, and from the law? But if she can apply to her position what you say you do to yours, I would argue that it is possible.
Well, sure, it is possible, but it's in her job, it's a lot harder than in mine. So in my job, that's the job. The job is, if I'm writing about Maria and Michael, I've got to understand where they're coming from, what is the source of their views, why they come to these views, even if I think they're weird or whatever I think of them. In her job, she has to apply the law, and you know, to a judge or a lawyer, there is a right answer there somewhere. In my job, there is no right answer. In her job, there is, and so that's why those battles in her field get so pitched, because each ideology believes that it has found the right answer. And so the liberals on the court and the conservatives on the court, although there are many areas in which they agree, in those areas where they disagree, each side thinks they're right and the other one's wrong. In my work, I think everybody has their own rightness. Everyone has their own truth in some sense. There is such a thing as facts, and some people's perspectives can be factually, you know, based on a fallacy. And we see that with, you know, some of the extremists who we're dealing with in our country today. But what makes journalism interesting is the fact that you can go out there and really dig into someone's life, and as much as they'll let you in, begin to understand how they came to believe what they believe.
And then as a follow-up, I just want to mention you won the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting in 2016 and the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service in 2014. What was that like?
Well, it was obviously a great honor. One was part of a big project that we did at the Post. I did with a number of my colleagues on police shootings around the country. We looked, it was a very rigorous look at every police shooting that we had collected. We created the first really comprehensive database of police shootings. This is before the FBI really tried to do that in any serious way. And we were able to do a series of stories that looked at where such shootings happen, why they happen, in certain departments and certain cities more than others, what the demographic and racial element of those of that data really was, and all of that. So it was a, you know, obviously we didn't know that those issues would be quite as powerfully at the forefront of American society in the years after that. But I think we gave people a lot of the information they needed to come to good and clear viewpoints on that question. And then the other one was, again, a series that we did, a bunch of us at the Post, on surveillance. And this was around the time of the Snowden issue and all of the questions about government surveillance of Americans and private companies surveilling us and all of that. And so those were, I think, important stories about just what we believe about privacy and what our rights are. And one of the really telling things in that, in one of the stories I did for that project, was we polled Americans and then went and profiled people around the country about their what they really believe about privacy. And it was really remarkable to see how much people have given up on the idea of privacy, or never really believed in it in the first place, and are totally comfortable not only with Google and Facebook knowing so much about us, but even with the government knowing a lot about us, even though some people will often superficially say, oh, I don't want the government spying on me. When you start asking them about the individual things the government collects about us, they're mostly on board with it.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a guest on our show that talked exactly about that. Since you were
and congratulations, right?
Yeah, congratulations.
Awarded for excellence in newspaper journalism, literary achievements, and musical composition, and you've received two. What a career.
Yeah.
Although my musical compositions, I have to say, are kind of weak.
Well, that's okay. You know, I write country western, you know, lyrics to songs. My, I wish we had more time to talk about it, because I know that you wrote on rock and roll and in something called Something in the Air. But let me ask you, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this question, since you were on the Metro desk. I've just written an editorial, which the Post actually has agreed to put online next week. And the nexus of it is that I think it's time for us to abandon the idea of talking about statehood for the District of Columbia strictly on social justice, on the issue of social justice. I think we should embrace what the Republicans have accused us of for the past 30 years, putting two more Democrats in the United States Senate. We just spent $500 million to get two Democrats elected from Georgia. You know, if you make the District of Columbia state, you get two Democratic senators automatically. So that's my argument, is let's embrace that and push for that to get the country, all the Democrats in the country behind us, because we're going to need something in the Senate that we didn't need in the House. And it's a long shot. We, as you know, we need 60 votes to pass it, but there's a chance, a slim chance, of invoking the nuclear option, getting rid of the filibuster temporarily, and making it happen. What do you think? I've had mixed results. Some people say I'm crazy to go that route.
I would never say that you're crazy, but I don't see that happening, certainly in our lifetimes. I think the closest the district ever came to statehood was when it was a Republican-led, or at least Republican acquiesced movement, where there were going to be additional senators for a District of Columbia state, and there would be more representation for, I believe it was Utah. This was an Orrin Hatch proposal with Tom Davis from Virginia. And I think that's the kind of scenario in which something like that could happen perhaps down the road. Certainly retrocession to Maryland seems more politically plausible, although I know it's distasteful to many people in the district.
And Maryland.
Well, yes, and Maryland, certainly in Baltimore, right. But, just D.C. statehood on its own, I just don't see any path to that. You know, obviously, you know far more about it than I do. But my impression has always been that if it were ever to happen, it would have to be as part of a classic bipartisan deal where both parties got something out of it.
Yeah. That's one of our problems, is that not only do Republicans not see anything in the bill for them, but people across America don't see it either. They don't feel our pain because we're the only ones in this situation. So they see it as something that only helps the people of District Columbia and doesn't impact them at all. So it's not that they don't sympathize. They just, you know, they've got bigger fish to fry. Maria, go ahead. Ask your question.
I have to, and I, Mark, if you don't want to make a comment or you can't comment, I totally understand, because this is in my bailiwick. The one thing that I can point to that President Trump did was sign on Tuesday, January 5th, a bill called H.R. 6100, which is to stop female genital mutilation or strengthening the opposition to female genital mutilation of 2020. So it was passed in the House, it passed in the Senate, it went to the president. If he didn't sign it, it would have died because it couldn't roll over. And I am a huge advocate for eradicating this practice, not only here in the United States, but globally. So I just want to give some kudos to President Trump for doing it. And apparently some of Ivanka and other entities that I know of personally who helped write the legislation were responsible for having him sign it. And I don't know if you can comment on that at all, Mark, or if it's just too niche, but it's gotten very, 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 very little publicity because of what happened this week.
Yeah, and I don't know the details of that, but I do know that there have been a number of issues along the way where Trump signed or even advocated for bills that were, you know, not really his bailiwick, that didn't fit in with a lot of the sort of public notion of who he is and what he stands for. And part of that is because, to some degree, on some issues, he just didn't care. And if there was some, you know, interested donor or family member who was pushing a particular issue, he would just go along with it. In other cases, he was in sort of classic politician form. He was catering to a particular voting group. And so, you know, you saw a particular emphasis, aside from his pardons of his cronies and people who had helped him, he also pardoned a number of unusual number of African American prisoners or ex-prisoners, and you know, someone might look at his record on race or his record on crime and say that's unusual for Donald Trump. But he was trying, as he had his initial campaign and throughout his presidency, to break the Democratic stranglehold on the black vote, and so he would look for ways that he could appeal to various minority groups as a way of breaking up the classic Democratic coalition. And you have to look at the 2020 election results and see that he had some success with that. He made significant gains with blacks, with Hispanics, with Asian Americans, to the great surprise, I think, of many Democrats. And he had been, his administration had been working on this for the entire time.
Yeah.
Well, that was a good perspective to put it in, because the United States had passed a federal law in 1996, but it was thrown out in 2018 when a federal judge said it was unconstitutional cutting in the United States. So this closes that loophole and makes it more severe in the punishment thereof. But thank you for giving perspective about why he may have done it, because again, the first story I saw written about it was from Reuters, of course, and that was on January 7th of this week. So I haven't seen much coverage here in the United States. But again, we had a huge tragedy that happened on Wednesday. Yeah, so I understand.
Yeah, and let me just say, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't point this out, Maria. You know that I very much believe in this issue, and I've stood with you on it. But yes, I do find it a little ironic, given the comments you made to Billy Bush, that he's the president, yes, that signed it into law.
Yes.
Right, but as I said at the beginning, there is no past tense for Donald Trump.
Right.
So he would never, that obvious link that you made would never cross his mind. And if you confronted him with it and said, how could you do this when you did that? He would say, what does that have to do with this?
Well, you know what? One thing that surprises me, Mark, is that given the fact that everybody talks about his narcissism and his myopia and how he's so self-centered, why in the world wouldn't he resign in order to make Pence the president, who could then pardon him for sure? We don't know if Donald Trump can pardon himself, but we're pretty sure that Pence could pardon him. Is his ego such that that's even more important to him than his survival? Because he certainly will be charged with crimes when he leaves office.
Well, I don't know that he will. I think, you know, he certainly could be, but I don't know that he will. But to your point, it is a question of ego. It's more than a question of ego. It's a question of his upbringing, of the way in which his father raised him, or some would say abused him. There is no greater disgrace in Donald Trump's imagination than to be thought of as a loser. That's why he did this crazed reaction to the election. That's why he is risking everything, even at this late date. And so, you know, is it possible that he'll resign in order to assure himself of a pardon? I guess it's theoretically possible, but I would be extremely surprised, because stepping away, resigning, is one of the ultimate loser moves in his mind. And his father taught him from the youngest age that there is no lower creature on earth than a loser. And his father told him from this very early age, you must always win. You must always be a killer. And that stuck with him. He was always trying to please his father. His father was a very distant, difficult, angry person. And Donald could never quite live up to what his father expected. Donald was not the first choice to take over the family business. His older brother was, but his older brother died at a young age. And Donald was kind of thrust into this and never was able to satisfy his father. And this is really the core question in his life. And so anything that smacks of losing is simply unacceptable to him. And so that's why you're seeing this very public, humiliating struggle that he's had with accepting the basic fact of the election.
He was just banned from Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. This is his outlet to the world. Is this dangerous by making him more isolated and not giving him an outlet? Do you think this makes him more dangerous in the remaining short time we have left?
I think it makes him angrier, and he'll rage about it, and he'll feel put upon and victimized, and that's when he tends to lash out and be the provocateur. But it comes at an almost absurdly late date, given the damage that he was able to do through his Twitter account for all these years. But he will not react well to it, and on the other hand, it will make it more difficult for him to reach his base in the ways he's been accustomed to. Now, the base isn't going to react well to it either. And anytime, you know, this is one of the central lessons we've seen from whether it's Nazi Germany or other dictatorships around the world. When you try to suppress and silence a message, people are very ingenious, and they will find ways around that. And so just as we've seen a movement from Fox to Newsmax and One America News, and just as we've seen movement online from Twitter and Facebook to Parler and Gab, the radicals, the extremists, will find places to gather, and Trump will meet them there. And so on the one hand, that makes him more frustrated and in a greater rage. On the other hand, it does break away probably some of his mainstream support. And just as we've seen any number of Republicans edging away or resigning from the cabinet, or people in Congress who had been absolute toadies for the last 4 years suddenly saying that they've broken with him, I think you'll see more of that among moderate and reasonable Republican voters, and you'll see the more extremist types doubling down and following Trump to whatever new outlets he goes to.
Maria, so do you have...
Yeah, Mark, I have to say it's been a pure delight to hear your point of view, and thank you for making the time for Shadow Politics. And being trained as a psychologist, I have this tendency to, what you say and how you say it, that you are a hopeful person, a glass half full, an optimistic person. Do I have that correct?
I kind of waver. My son often accuses me of being too glass half full. As a journalist, there's always a tendency to look on the darker side.
Right, that's what I'm saying. And I believe me, I'm the same way. I don't find that bad or wrong or a character flaw at all. But it's surprising to me because of what you've done and for so long. I believe you basically started your career as a journalist in 1980. And for you to be hopeful and optimistic when you've seen the worst, just like law enforcement does, what do you think that's about?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a misconception. I think most journalists, although we often traffic in bad news and we are constantly trying to, figure out what nefarious deeds people are up to, I think at bottom, to do this work, you have to be someone who believes in improvement and who believes that people are basically good and that they may be misguided, but that they want to do good. If you don't believe that, why would you be in a field where you are writing about the flaws in society and other than to look for fixes, other than to look for solutions? There'd be no reason to do the work otherwise. So I think although journalists are often seen as people who look at the dark side of things, my experience with my colleagues has always been that they tend to be, if anything, sometimes overly optimistic and looking for the good in all the people we write about and report on.
Because if it bleeds, it leads. I think that's why we think.
Well, but that's a cliche for a reason. So there's always an element of truth to a cliche, but it's also a cliche because it's an easy pat way of looking at things. And good journalists look for the complexity. I always tell when I'm editing, I always tell my reporters, don't bring me the black and white. Bring me the gray. The gray is the interesting part. Anyone can write about the black and white issues and the people on the extremes. It's the people in the middle. It's the ideas in the middle where people are confused and don't really know what they think or why they think it. That's where you find the most interesting stories.
Nice.
Well, we're running out of time here, Mark. You've been so kind to take this time to be with us, and we don't want to keep you any longer than necessary. But I want to give you a little advice before you leave, though. Don't take criticism from your adult children. My three adult children are home, and I would have told you that they are among the three most spoiled children on the planet. But now I find that they were raised in a gulag, and I am the prime despot because I ask him to take out the trash every single while. So
exactly.
No, take that with a big grain of salt. But anyway, thank you so much, Mark Fisher, for being with us. You're kind to give us of your time at this critical time when the country's in upheaval, and we hope maybe in a better day we can have you back again sometime. We always leave our show with a song, and I know that you're an old rock and roller, so from one old rock and roller to another, I've been wanting to play this song for 4 years, but I don't think I had the guts to do it. We're going to leave you with the Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil. Maria, you get the last word.
As always, thank you, Mark Fisher, for your time, and we thank our listeners for your devotion and for sharing our program with others as we increase our audience. We're grateful to you for that.
Thank you so much. And this song goes out to President Trump.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.